We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 37, Magical Mental Health. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Nishi Ravi about mental health in the wizarding world. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds Too.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions and cultural competency at Mount Carmel College and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Our topic today, Emily, is mental health in the magical community. But one of the questions I'm hoping we'll explore a little bit is how the Harry Potter series can be useful to us muggle readers as bibliotherapy when we're struggling in our own lives. And I wondered, Emily, have you found the Harry Potter books to be helpful to you as you seek your own mental balance?
That's funny that you should ask, and I've probably told this story before on the podcast, but the reason that I even picked them up in the first place is because I had just completed my first semester of graduate school, and we had read a lot of very heady theological volumes. And one of my classmates, who is still one of my best friends, Kukwa, hello Kukwa, she handed me the first three books in a little, you know, in a little set, and she said, "Oh, here, read these. These will be like kind of mental brain candy for you." And she was right. I tore through them, and I, you know, really, really enjoyed them. But I think it was not just sort of an intellectual break. And it's funny and ironic because it wasn't really even an intellectual break for me. It really fired me into a direction.
Oh,
intellectually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you haven't exactly just been sitting on the couch with it, Emily.
I know. And you know, I try to wrap it all into the theology that I learned, that I still learn, you know. But I do think that it was also a way for me to just achieve some balance and to do some pleasure reading, because I think I had gotten out of pleasure reading altogether, because when you're in college, you're having to read so much stuff that you have to read that you sort of forget what it feels like to read for pleasure. And when you're not doing your homework or doing your schoolwork, you just want to watch TV or chill out, be with friends. And so I think it really helped me to get back into pleasure reading in general, which is something that is really important for me as a way of balancing my work and my leisure time. And I mean, I see that as, that's a roundabout way of saying, yes, I think it does.
Right.
What about you? How does it work
for you?
Well,
you know, you just with what you were saying, you made me think of something that I hadn't really thought about before, which is, so my Fitbit, which I like my Fitbit.
Yeah, you do.
It records my sleep. And I'm always interested to see how did I do. And one of the things I've noticed is that it often records me as sleeping when I know I'm just reading my book. And sometimes, in fact, it records me as deep sleep when I'm reading my book. And so reading itself as just a way to decompress and relax. Mm-hmm. Like I woke up very early in the morning this morning, and I was all stirred up. And then I was like, I'm just going to have to bring out my book and read it. And then I looked and you could see it on the Fitbit, and it said, well, and then you went back to sleep. And I was like, no. But it's funny how reading can serve that. And that just made me think of that. But I was really also thinking, when I was thinking about this, about something really similar to you when I was in graduate school. Gosh, it's just so grueling. And I was when I read the Harry Potter books, and it was just the first three that were out at that point, I was able to relate to all the school stuff in the books, you know, the unfairness and the personality struggles and the professors who seem arbitrary, even the good ones sometimes seem arbitrary. You have no idea why they're doing the things they're doing. And even the imposter pressure. Syndrome, you know, I don't really belong here. And that really it was helpful for me to see that playing out in this other setting.
Yeah.
And it was really helpful to me. And sort of like what you said also, it speaks to something profound in the human spirit, these books. Mm-hmm. And when you're mired in academic striving, you can sort of forget that that's ultimately why you got into it in the first place. And so it was replenishing for me in a difficult time. And I bet our listeners have had similar experiences, or different ones. And listeners, if you have had an experience of the Harry Potter books, you know, helping you through a difficult time in some way, we would love to hear about that. So please drop us a note. We would be honored to hear your experiences there. Well, helping us to reflect on that question, but also to analyze the way mental health is treated in the series as a whole, is Nishi Ravi. Nishi is a psychodynamic and person-centered psychotherapist trained at the University of Edinburgh. She has been in the mental health field since 2014 in multiple countries and in various capacities. After independently running a private practice in India, Nishi is pursuing her PhD in counseling psychology at Marquette University. Her research interests are primarily qualitative in nature, focusing on lived experience, counselor training, trauma, and culture. Welcome to the show, Nishi.
Hi, Katie. Thanks for that introduction.
Well, Nishi, we know that you are connected to us through our wonderful MuggleNet producer, Lori Beckoff, and you two must have met at the University of Edinburgh, and I wondered if you two talked Potter with each other a lot.
It's so funny you asked this, because that is exactly what brought the two of us, I think, as close as we did end up getting each other. Because we had first met online and we knew that we were flatmates of some sort. And I think the both of us had sort of looked each other up online to see who we'd be living with. And we both discovered that the other was a Potterhead, and it just took off from there. So that was just such a fantastic experience.
I love that. Potter friends, Potter friendships. That's a lot of what we're built on. Emily and I, we would not know each other if not for Harry Potter.
Yeah, we're friends in Potter.
Yeah, we're friends in Potter. Well, Nishi, tell us how you first encountered the Harry Potter series and what drew you to it.
Oh, Katie, I was 11 when I started reading the books. And for
perfect.
I was just instantly hooked, and it just matched the ages of the characters as well. So for me, it was that very typical adolescent time when I was really trying to find myself and who I was. And honestly, I didn't have a whole lot of personality options to explore. So it was really easy to find myself in the pages of books and create this link to reality and find out a way to interact with the world that felt like me. It really was the space for many of us to step through this proverbial platform 9 3/4 into this idealized world of magic and friendship and adventure. And so, like, this big part of me would often idealize how simpler life would be if I went to Hogwarts or if I had this magic wand. But then to also read some of what these characters were going through in the book, whether it was, like you mentioned, like awful teachers or like bullies, complex family dynamics. In a sense, all these characters were trying to find themselves as well. So being able to really find that parallel that no matter what world you're in, sometimes those struggles really just transfer across was so heartening to feel. And you really just feel seen as a teenager there.
I love that, right? And specifically because of the age where you encountered it, it was just really relevant to your experience as you're becoming yourself.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It was, for me, Harry Potter was just that first portal where I learned to conceptualize and understand myself. The books were, it was almost like these books were holding up mirrors, and I could catch glimpses of myself in all of these different mirrors. And that sort of bloomed into this passion for me to also help people understand themselves and what it means to be able to be a therapist and sort of hold that mirror to other folks as well. So a big part of who I am has been shaped by Harry Potter.
Wow. Wow. What a great answer.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
Really.
That's really great. And now I'm starting to think about the books that I was reading at that age and wonder, because Harry Potter wasn't around. And I'm like, oh, wow. No, I did have kind of a fascination with Jane Eyre. So I'm like kind of wondering about that one. I'll have to think about that later.
Oh my. Well, a lot of the Wizarding World characters are dealing with various traumas in their past. And also, of course, the story itself is constantly presenting new crises. Who in the stories do you think deals well with trauma and who struggles more? And also, like, what does it even mean to deal well with trauma? I don't even know what I mean by that. Help us out, Nishi.
Yeah, because when we talk about dealing with trauma, one, there is no singular definition of even what the trauma is or what it means to deal well with it. The definitions of trauma have changed and evolved so much even as the years have passed. And there's just, even in the mental health world, there's so many debates on what counts as trauma. Is it the actual event that occurred, or is it more of a response of what happens inside you because of what happens to you? So when we talk about dealing well with trauma, it's such a complex phenomena to actually hold and sit with and even talk to someone about. I would say maybe the only, I don't even know if I could call it a common factor, but someone who might quote unquote deal well with trauma, maybe individuals who at some point are able to understand that while they may not have been responsible for that trauma, they are still responsible for their healing. And that, in my definition, is the closest way to dealing with trauma in that healthy way. So if you look at some of the characters from the book, the one that really springs to mind all the time is Neville, because I think for me, he was one of my favorite characters who just manages his trauma so beautifully in such an intricate way, because he carries this very intense trauma that we don't even know the full story about. But he continues to maintain social relationships. He really does his best and acts within his scope of competence. And while he's so portrayed as this slightly bumbling, funny, goofy kind of guy who's just anxious and kind of messy, but we also see how he takes a stand so many times through the books. He finds a way to stand up for what he believes in, and he almost uses that trauma as a moral foundation for his actions. Versus when you look at the antithesis of that is Snape, where he also found a sense of purpose with his trauma and really does his best to operate within his scope of competence. He's brilliant at potions and probably Defense Against the Dark Arts as well. But it seems like he hadn't found his way to cope with or process his trauma. He doesn't really forge any form of interpersonal relationships with those around him. Instead, he chooses to project a lot of that trauma and grief and rage onto individuals who don't really hold the same power that he does. So when you talk about dealing with trauma, you really see this whole spectrum in the books and in these characters. And for me, I see it go all the way from Neville, who just does it so beautifully in the most endearing manner, to Snape, who, you know, we only sort of understood a little bit of where he was coming from more towards the end, very, very end of the series.
Yeah, can I tell you how much I love the pairing of Neville and Snape on this question? Really interesting to think of those two characters together. And of course, they have a lot of like conflicts themselves. And Snape sometimes bullies Neville. And yet Neville he's really resilient. I think about, you know, how his uncle was going to drop him out the window. Because he wasn't showing magical promise, and trying to force him to reveal it. And then he bounces back.
He bounced. I know. He really did drop him out the window. He just bounced.
And he bounces. And there's something about that that's very noble. And like you said, endearing. And it doesn't seem to stop him from creating those healthy relationships like you were talking about. As Snape's, obviously he grows up in trauma. You know, we know a little bit about Snape's background there, but then the way that he deals with that leads him into more traumatic events with Lily and so on. And he's also coping. I like that you pointed that out too. I'm just thinking aloud at this point. You've given me a lot to think about, Nishi.
Yeah, right. Right. Yeah. His coping gets all over other people in a bad way, but Neville's never seems to, you know? Whereas, you know, yeah, Neville is, yeah, that bouncing is a real metaphor for his resilience. And you're right. I think when he stands up to the trio, as the first book is climaxing, you know, he is doing, you can see him thinking, what would my parents do here? You know, what would my parents do? And he doesn't fully understand the situation, which is a problem, but he, you know, he does something brave and he stands up for what he thinks is right. Mm-hmm. And that's really heartening. It's really heartening. What about Harry? What do you think? Does Harry cope in a particular way?
Undoubtedly. I think Harry demonstrates a lot of that similar strength and resilience with all of the trauma and loss that he's faced. And also this very physically and emotionally abusive household that he's been in for so long. And the fact that when he goes to Hogwarts, he's not going into an active safe zone either. He's still being thrust into danger year after year.
Right.
It almost feels like he doesn't really get to exit his fight or flight state. He's always in the midst of something or the other. But that being said, I don't think that Harry's even come close to processing any of that trauma that he's been through. There's only been, I think, one or two points in the series that Harry tries to process some of his trauma with Dumbledore, which is a luxury that nobody else at Hogwarts really seems to receive. So even when you look at going back to our previous example of Neville, it's not that, you know, all these traumatic events tested his resilience. If anything, his bouncing exists regardless of whether it was tested or not. And I think maybe that's what Rowling was trying to show with Harry, that he is just resilient regardless of what's being thrown at him. It's just the resilience that keeps being tested. But something that I do wish we could have had a little bit more of, because it was just such a poignant scene. I think it was in the fifth book where he's just really trying to process that the grief of losing his godfather, losing just so much innocence in that moment where he's already seen Cedric die previously. And now he's the closest thing that he has to an immediate family figure. The closest link to his parents is also gone in this case. And having Dumbledore really listen to Harry's grief in that moment, I wish we had seen more moments like that for Harry. We've seen the way he copes. He's found his set of people that he can rely on. And to his credit, enormous credit, he found people that were good for him. He could have really easily just become friends with Malfoy in his first year and really given Harry that sense of control that he has been missing for so long in his life. He could have just been sorted into Slytherin, gotten a sense of power that he has lacked his whole life. He could have had his own version of maybe Crabbe and Goyle and Malfoy just pedestalizing him further. But he really broke away from the pattern of choosing people to maintain appearances, which is what his uncle and aunt do quite a lot. So he breaks away from these very negative patterns that he's been entrenched in for so long, and instead chose friends that grounded him, that really called him out on his antics, and they really, really cared for him. And for survivors of trauma to actually make some of these decisions and break away from cycles is so beautiful, and it's so difficult to break away from the patterns that they witness and for them to go on to take that challenge and make healthier decisions, because as beautiful as healthier decisions are, it's also straying away from what they have known their whole life. Mm-hmm. So I think for Harry to be able to make those very mature adult decisions at the age of 11 is just fantastic.
Yeah. And you know, what I'm thinking about is you're talking about Harry really breaking from the pattern that he had witnessed, you know, among the Dursleys, particularly. He doesn't know his parents enough to know what they were like. I think about Luna, who in some ways, she's not breaking away from the family cycle. And she's had a lot of, you know, she's had the trauma of, she watched her mother kill herself through this experimentation. Mm-hmm. And how do you think Luna is dealing with her traumas?
Luna is just such a fascinating character, like just one of those instantly likable characters that you read about. Like, oh my goodness. The first thing I remember thinking about Luna when I read about her was just, she is so untethered from what everybody else posits is a reality. No one's really sort of grounded her in this in a typical or even neurotypical sense. And she's just sort of been branded by a lot of people as kooky or crazy. And in her own very admirable way, she found out how to cope with her loss and trauma, with a lot of the experimentation that her own mother went through. She still sort of dabbles in the idea of however you can call mysticism or some of the more odd beliefs that she holds. She still sort of almost uses that as this tether to her mother, to her father, that she may have even distanced herself from after the loss of her mother. With her being able to find her people, even within the DA, these people around her really helped her embrace her personality, because her coping was not spilling onto others. It wasn't putting others at risk. And also a very helpful thing was that the people around her, the DA, Harry, Ron, Neville, Ginny, they were also teenagers. They weren't trying to offer her therapy or tell her what they thought was best for her to do or the right way to behave. They just showed up for her, which I think is so, so important, one, at that age in general, but also for the things that Luna has been through that nobody else really got to know a whole lot about, but they just showed up. And I think that was just a beautiful demonstration of what you can do with the resources you have.
Right. Well, and yeah, and the power of, you know, social interaction and peer interaction and friends.
Friends. Well, Nishi, our producer and friend and your friend, Lori Beckhoff, she gave us a question to ask on her behalf. And so she wants to know about Harry and his acceptance of Umbridge's punishment of him in Order of the Phoenix, the carving of I must not tell lies into his hand. She looks at this through a lens of self-harm, because she says Harry accepts it and he hides it from other people. Maybe even I would add the positioning of where it is, you know, is pretty typical for self-harm. Would you agree with that kind of a lens, or do you think that there's some other way to understand what's happening to Harry here?
I'll leave it to Lori to ask the most layered, nuanced questions out there.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Gosh, I miss you, Lori. No, but this was actually the question that I've spent the longest time reflecting on, because I was sitting with what it is to be self-harm. And even during our classes and seminars at school, we talk about the definitions of self-harm. And I think at one point someone even brought up this hypothetical of if there's an individual who chooses to get tattoos every time they feel hurt or upset, is that a form of self-harm? Because it's something it does leave sort of a permanent marking on you, but it doesn't fall under the same category of what you might imagine self-harm to be. In this case, I see where Lori's also coming from, and I'm also going to throw something out there, and I'd love to hear how you understand this as well, because what Umbridge did, that was just a truly evil punishment meted out to Harry by someone that undoubtedly just has all the power in this dynamic. And for Harry, I'm almost wondering if this is a sense of masochistic reparation, where he feels like he just owes to people, because Harry's entire existence has been based on the sacrifice that other people have made, like all these sacrifices that people have made for him ever since he was born, because he is this golden chosen one. And moreover, none of the people who have sacrificed for Harry and for the greater good ever really held it against Harry, ever brought it up against him. And this is a lot of pressure for anyone, let alone a teenager. So I'm almost wondering if Harry's just containing this huge amount of guilt for everything that he thinks he is putting all these people through. So every time Harry takes this punishment from Umbridge, he offers himself up as this paeculum in a way of masochistic reparations, again, for all these people who have put themselves in danger or given up their lives for him.
Wow, what a really interesting reading.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
really, I will tell you, Nishi, we had a lot of back and forth on this question on our little, you know, Potterversity team message. we were debating it among ourselves, and we didn't hit that one. So that's really eye-opening. That's really interesting. And I think there's a way that, you know, he wears it, of course, but when he takes it on, I think there's a kind of almost pride that mm-hmm. he's doing it, that mm-hmm. what you're talking about, I think would fit in with. And we had talked a little bit about that, right? And also showing her that he's not bowed mm-hmm. by mm-hmm. what she's mm-hmm. doing.
Oh, there's a big percentage of that's going on here is him just trying to show her it doesn't really bother me. But I also am struck by, Nishi, what you were saying, in the Christian tradition, especially in the Catholic tradition, mm-hmm. there is this, I remember hearing my parents say, especially my mother, who was raised Catholic, say that we were to offer things up, offer up our sufferings, mm-hmm. right? And this is this idea of, because Jesus suffered so much for the sake of the redemption of the whole world, the little sufferings that we experience every day, or even the big sufferings that are really, you know, tragic, those mm-hmm. can be offered as kind of a sacrifice in return, you know? Mm-hmm. And I wonder, because of the strong Christian themes in many other parts of the book, I wonder if that there's something there that's at work as well, that fits in with, I think, what you're saying.
Absolutely. Because Harry also just has this belief that all of his actions are only allowed to be geared towards the greater good or some larger than life noble cause. Even if it's something as small as breaking the rules, on a very like low stakes level, because I'm thinking of the first book where Draco steals Neville's Remembrall and Professor Hooch, Madam Hooch says, "You're not allowed to fly." But in that moment, Harry's like, Harry needs to stand up for what he believes to be just in that moment. And it's so rare in the book that we see what Harry does purely for himself or in his own interest. And I think the only moment of joy that's coming to my mind is when he sneaks into Hogsmeade under the cloak just to experience Puff and Honeydukes. And I'm like, that's the first time I'm seeing this child, this actual 13-year-old who just wants to be a 13-year-old and isn't so focused on saving the world, saving the people around him, and just offering him up as the proverbial pig for slaughter for everybody else.
Right. He just wants to go get some candy.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's pretty typical.
I was thinking about that too. So it's funny that when you started talking about that, my first thought was, you know, the honeydukes as just kind of a typical thing.
And throw snowballs at Malfoy.
Well, yeah. Right.
Yeah,
right? There's that. Not actually a noble cause there. Maybe there is. I don't know. Maybe.
I don't know.
Well,
but it's him like finally being a teenager, which is just it's so
right.
Nice to see.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Well, if we turn now to some of the adults, do we mm-hmm. think the adults in the children's lives are good models for positive mental health? Do they tend to approach the various crises with a greater maturity than the children do? What do you think about how, you know, some of the adults are dealing with the very, you know, tense and difficult situations in the wizarding world?
Being a psychodynamic practitioner, I have just so many feelings about how behaviors are modeled to children.
Mm.
And through the book, we see not just like the parents and the families, but also the teachers and the headmaster fall on different parts of the spectrum of how they can be positive or negative role models. So if you take Harry's aunt and uncle, they were most probably victims of their own upbringing and traumas, and not to mention just existing in this upper middle class capitalist bubble where they just want to conform to what it means to be a normal, happy family in society, no matter what the cost is. But if you go on to more like very, very clearly positive role models in Harry's life, I think the first one that's going to pop up would be Professor McGonagall, who has been, you know, the embodiment of consistency, which I think Harry's turbulent life desperately needs.
Hmm.
But McGonagall goes above and beyond to provide what all those children need, which is structure. She's very strict, but she cares so deeply because no matter what is going on outside those four walls of Hogwarts, her students need to focus on being students, going to school, turning in the homework, and just being safe. You know, she's created this space of stability in an extremely chaotic period, not just with a bunch of hormonal teenagers, but a brewing war. I would say McGonagall and Hagrid were the first adults to treat Harry with respect and be these positive figures in his life. And you see this right from the first book, you know, in the first book where McGonagall tells Harry, you know, your father would be so proud of you, when it's something just to do with Quidditch and sports. And you just see this change, this confidence that goes through Harry in that moment. So much so to the point where in the third book, Harry asks her to be his guardian and sign his permission slip. So she's embodiment of motherly safety for Harry. You know, she defends him above and beyond what she could ever do, what anyone could ever do for just a student. Where in the fifth book, where she just really stands up to Umbridge and says she's willing to coach Harry nightly so that he can become an Auror. And it's very rare that you see that kind of passion for people in professors alone who just, you know, are trying to treat all their students equally.
Right. And that resonates so strongly with me. I was thinking about my kids went to an after school program, and the person who set up that program was particularly concerned for kids who would be like latchkey kids who would go home to an empty house at the, you know, at the end of school. And she was a tough woman, Alice Chapman. And she always struck me as very brusque, and she seemed really strict, and she was really direct with kids. And they loved her because they knew she was in their corner, and she was one of their biggest supporters. And you have that, like you said, structure and consistency, but a really unflagging support. And that is just so, so important for kids. I just got a chill thinking about that.
Yeah, I've heard, I can't remember who did this comparison, but they were talking about the different symbols and, you know, Dumbledore's got the half moon spectacles, right? Because he's not going to complete the heroic journey. That's left to Harry, who has the full round glasses. But McGonagall's are square. And they talk about, you know, the narrative identifies them more than once as being square. And that, and this puts her kind of outside that quest, but then that Harry and Dumbledore share, but then it also is this symbol of like stability and it's you know, kind of being a foundation, right?
Because other than the school part of the maternal parts within the school that Harry's trying to identify with, outside of that, the only family that he can really identify with would be the Weasleys, who demonstrated just such unconditionality. Even when Percy strays away from them, they don't shy away from embracing him when he's ready to return. And that's such a beautiful metaphor for what family is, really. And that's what Harry's able to be witness to, that even if he's this outsider, they treat him like their own son, both in the most positive of ways, in terms of, you know, giving him the basic necessities of food and Christmas presents every year and shelter. But also, Mrs. Weasley doesn't shy away from shouting at him or telling him or grounding him at times and telling him to go to bed at a certain hour because it's late. Which no one's ever like done for Harry before. And the part that always makes me smile when I think about how beautiful that parental relationship is, I can't remember which book this was in, I think possibly the sixth book. But when everyone's being just very cautious about who they're letting into their homes to make sure it's not a Death Eater. And, you know, Harry hears the nickname Molly Wobbles come out, and he's so embarrassed that he's witnessing his own parents like kissing or being mushy. And that was because if it was just anybody else, you could just go, oh, that's so sweet to see these two people still engaging in affection. But for him, it's this active embarrassment in that moment, and he's trying to do anything he can to not hear mom and dad be cute with each other. And I think that moment just encompasses everything that he feels for them, which is they are his parents in so many ways. And I mean, they also did a fantastic job of keeping the normalcy within a crazy war going on, just like Professor McGonagall did. They didn't stop celebrating birthdays. They had a wedding because they wanted to still hold those values of family and love and affection, even in the moments where they were being tested the most. And I think for Harry, again, it's just another symbolism of how that love and protection he has is what is going to get him through the worst parts of his life.
When you think about Molly Weasley, she's wanting to protect Harry from a lot of the realities of what's going on. And Arthur Weasley, he's the one who tells Harry, hey, let me tell you about this guy, Sirius Black. All right. He doesn't say all the things, but it's a little man-to-man kind of talk, I think, in a way that just strikes me as not only fatherly, but really respectful of Harry as a person who is his own person in his own right. And I like the balance of that. Again, it strikes me as, again, modeling really, you know, parental roles to Harry.
They don't try and be perfect. And that's the best part, I think. Harry's able to see that even when these are flaws, the love is always what is going to come through. And he's able to hold on to that. But if you look at Malfoy, on the other hand, this poor child.
Oh, yeah.
I spoke about how a lot of identity exploration is seeing glimpses of yourself in those around you, or connecting with people and books and movies that you're exposed to. Malfoy never had that chance because everybody were too busy holding up the mirrors to themselves and not to him to actually understand what he looks like, who he really is. He could only model what was demonstrated to him, and he never really received an opportunity to understand or reflect on what it was that he wanted. And so as an individual, when your avenues of self-reflection and introspection are taken away from you, especially at such a young age, much like Harry, Draco also couldn't process any of the trauma that he's witnessed. It's only when he's confronted by Dumbledore moments before he's supposed to kill Dumbledore that we catch a glimpse of this very vulnerable child who's been thrust into a position he does not want to be in. And, you know, he really felt like he couldn't say no to so much because he just was craving that kind of parental, familial, societal approval. So you can really see how the poor parental modeling there has really takes over Draco's life.
I love how you bring in the mirror idea because, of course, his mother is Narcissa. And Narcissus is the one who, like,
right,
was only looking at himself and drowns. And so when your mother is Narcissa, like you say, she's not going to be a mirror for Draco. And I know there are people who are, you know, they think Narcissa comes through in the end. But I think what you're saying, to me, I think it really makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, she might not have had to come through in the end if she would have come through sooner, you know? Right.
And let's not even get started on Lucius.
Oh my, yeah, Lucius, woof. So what about the school itself? I note there is not a school counselor at Hogwarts.
Oh, Hogwarts.
Not on staff.
Are they in
staff.
Compliance?
I don't know. I don't
State
know about
regulations.
That. So how does the school maybe promote or inhibit healthy coping strategies? And do you think that the school counselor, if they had one, would just be totally overrun all the time?
I'm going to get into some technicalities with the school promotes coping strategies because the school itself is not very conducive to the student's well-being, which means the students have to come up with coping strategies.
Yeah, when the staircases aren't even in the same place day after day, come on.
Right. When there's like a mortality warning on the third floor corridor, you know.
Right. Welcome to Hogwarts.
Imagine you're 11 years old. You're in this gigantic castle, which is like this idea of boarding school. You're far away from home. And the first thing you're doing is undergoing a personality test in front of the whole school.
Oh, yeah.
And
that's
you've
brutal.
Got a brand for life about your character. I'm just trying to imagine the kind of impact that has on your psyche. And like on a much smaller level, like, I still think about a BuzzFeed quiz that I took at age 14 that absolutely got me completely wrong. And it's just, and like, I can ignore a BuzzFeed quiz, but this is the consequences of getting sorted into quote unquote the wrong house, because multiple tables would boo if you were sorted into Slytherin, and you're 11. Yeah. You don't even know what a Slytherin is, good chances. So.
Right.
I'm not fully seeing how mental health is really approached in the wizarding world, at least during the school year. I don't imagine a school counselor being this hypothetical school counselor being any more or less overrun with students seeking help. But the other thing that I want to consider here is these teenagers are developing in this bubble of Hogwarts and are given an enormous power, which is a magic wand. So you pair this kind of magic with a teenage sense of invincibility, and you're going to have serious consequences.
Oh my.
But the wizarding world, that's like trouble. Most physical consequences are managed with magic. Mm-hmm. So teenagers don't really have an understanding of how consequences follow actions. And this can lead to them developing very convoluted coping skills because most things can just be taken care of with the wave of a wand. Yeah. So I think, yeah, towards the end when the war was more imminent, I think any kind of mental health practitioner would have had a lot more to deal with. But during the school year, while these characters are also dealing with very teenage struggles, there is so much more invincibility. Because I'm thinking of when Hermione was hexed and her teeth grew so much longer and she just got it fixed to the size she wanted. And not a right. lot of us really get that. We go through years of painful braces. Right. And that doesn't sort most things out. But in the magic world, there is a certain sense of invincibility that I think the students are shielded by.
You almost wonder if like Luna, if there was ever the thought of modifying her memory so that she didn't have the memory of, you know, not her mother, but seeing her mother die. You know,
yeah, modification is one of these things that,
it's problematic.
Wow, it's psychologically really problematic. So that is a little bit of like the tiny bit that we can see in Hogwarts. But when we think large, more, you know, on the larger scale of what's happening in the wizarding world with mental health, we've got the examples, really, I think, of Neville's parents and Gilderoy Lockhart, both of whom end up, or all three of whom end up at St. Mungo's, suffering from severe psychological trauma. Mm-hmm. And they're, I guess, institutionalized there. What can we glean from the glimpses of their lives about the whole wizarding world approach to mental disability when people are really, they're not, wizards and witches are not invincible?
I think for the kind of advancements that you would expect in this magical world, it still seems like treatment and rehabilitation is very much in this Lazaretto Bedlam era. We get a brief glimpse into what this psych ward is like at St. Mungo's, but it doesn't really demonstrate rehabilitation, but rather just this institutionalized care home. And when you look at the psychological trauma, like Frank and Alice Longbottom were tortured to trauma, which is a whole separate category from what happened to Gilderoy Lockhart.
Right.
But even the when the children walk into the hospital and they see Frank and Alice Longbottom, they're so shocked because they have no idea how to react. This is not something they even thought about, even though Neville has never posited to live with his parents. He's only spoken about his grandmother. So they have no idea also how to react to these scenarios, because it seems like this is the first time a lot of them are even coming into brushes with either disability or any kind of neurodivergence in here. So the idea of reinstitution, of restitution and rehabilitation is also very far off, because from what we see here, it's very normalized to just mentally incapacitate people in this wizarding world that people disagree with. You know, the act of torture is not an uncommon feature, because we've seen that within their prison system as well.
Yeah, I was thinking of Azkaban. Yeah.
Yeah. Where people just believe like, oh, if you do bad shit, it's okay to torture you.
And the Dementors as the guards, that's just built-in torture and psychological torture.
So I just believe that the whole like long way to go in the wizarding world in terms of dealing with any kinds of trauma and disability.
Well, I totally agree with you, Niji.
Yeah, right. I do too. No, it's a very good point. We know, you know, increasingly that the unequal structures of our own society create mental health challenges and foster mental health challenges. How is this reflected in the wizarding world? How are those unequal structures likely to impact the mental health of characters from marginalized groups like Hagrid, who is a half giant, or Griphook, the goblin, or the house elves, Dobby and Winky and Creature?
I think this is important because it just goes beyond economic inequality, which I really like, but it really goes to talking about the marginalization of groups that don't look typical of what you might expect. And I think especially when you're thinking about the house elves, servitude has just been the major theme of their lives, to the point where they're so beaten into submission that even when they have the opportunity to be free, a lot of them still have a sense of learned helplessness, or they're still under that servitude mindset, that internalized servitude still continues to exist.
It's almost part of their identity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They've taken that on as who they are. And even when you think about Dobby's final act of valiance for Harry, where he saves Harry, how much of that is done out of servitude and indebtedness, as opposed to seeing Harry as a friend, he tries to see Harry as a friend, but to me, it was struck so much out of, you know, I am indebted to you and I'm willing to give my life to you because I'm indebted to you. And I don't know how aware he is of this, of the greater good, even. He just cares that Harry's the one who saved him.
And Creature, definitely, when he makes his change at the end, you definitely have the sense that he has not gotten out of that, you know, servant to the one he's loyal to kind of mentality.
Mm-hmm. And even if you think of the Tom Riddle versus Hagrid dynamic there, you know, Riddle's word was taken just at face value. And you have to question how much of that was because he was this charming, young, typical looking man, as opposed to Hagrid, who is this larger, bumbling half giant. And even when you look at the different professors at Hogwarts, Hogwarts has had some egregious professors, but Hagrid was one of the first to be removed from a post because of his bad or unsafe teaching methods, when they've literally had Lord Voldemort teach them. Mm-hmm. So you can see a lot of those aggressions come out, even from characters that you posit are positive, healthy people at Hogwarts, or, you know, are individuals who are advocates. You still see a lot of those kind of aggressions coming out towards marginalized communities. And the fear and the stigma of being different is so pervasive. Like, Katie, as you mentioned, Neville's uncle and grandmother, who were just so desperate for Neville to demonstrate magical abilities, throwing your child out of a window, throwing them into a lake. The stigma is just, there's just so much fear attached to being different. And you can't help but think on how much this is going to affect their mental health, just as it does in the real world.
Yeah, and you're making me think of Squibbs too. I mean, Filch is definitely, I think, bearing some, you know, some mental trauma of his own as a Squib who yet works at Hogwarts, you know. Yeah. And that comes from, again, from being seen as sort of outside of what the boundary of, like, proper or normal expectation is.
Yeah. And when people call Filch, you know, bad tempered or rude, I was just thinking, like, how else could anyone possibly react if this is the way they've been continually treated by society?
Yeah. Right. Not to mention the students, students themselves, who are kind of encouraged in it to some degree. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Nishi, what do you think readers can learn about mental health and their own coping strategies from reading the Harry Potter books? What's the you know, bibliotherapy angle that you think is maybe there for people?
Right, because I'm struck by the fact that we Katie, you and I at the beginning said so much about how these books were good for our personal balance, and, you know, but then we spent the whole conversation here talking about the deficiencies of the Wizarding World. So
truly,
what makes these books still so good for our mental health?
Right.
I think Emily, like, on one hand, while we can see these deficiencies in the books, they are reflections of what society is right now. And I think being able to prime children to understand some of these societal inequalities and inequities in a very palatable way, so as not to overwhelm them at the age of 9 or 10, but also give them a glimpse into how to understand the world later on. I think Harry Potter sets a great stage. It's an excellent primer on how to understand mental health problems and social inequalities. And as you grow up, to use what you've read in these books to engage in more progressive and serious actions and discussions around improving societal structures. Because as a kid, at least for me, not a lot of people discuss what mental health really means. You don't really have the vernacular or the language as a child to express what you might be experiencing inside you. So Harry Potter is a fantastic stepping stone to understand what is happening to people around you, what is happening inside of you, and seeing how unfair some structures can be. But also, like, no work of literature can really capture everything. It gives you a way to interact with the world in a safe way. It's a very safe launch pad to engage with more serious realities. And so I think the goal from there on would be to prospectively read more serious work, either in the mental health field, in the socio-political field. And as you get older, you're essentially engaging with the same ideas that you've been introduced to as a child, but you're doing that in a complex, nuanced, and a very sensitive fashion. So I think in that way, Harry Potter's been, it's a very, very good starting point for anyone to try and engage a little bit more with the society that they're in.
Yeah, and I think kind of what, to go back to what you were saying about what drew you into the books to begin with, you know, if you can identify with some of the struggles a particular character is going through, whichever one of the characters you're sort of seeing yourself use that mirror image, you're seeing yourself reflected in, that can actually be a really good way to suddenly see something that maybe you had not been able to see or articulate in your own well-being.
Absolutely. And with regards to this being therapeutic and Harry Potter being used for bibliotherapy, like something that I tell so many of my clients, so many groups that I facilitate, because something that I hear very often, especially with mood disorders and anxiety and depression being a really big one, where they say, I don't even know if I'm making this up because this is all just in my head. And I just love hitting them with the Dumbledore dialogue of like, just because it's in your head really doesn't mean it's not real. If anything, yeah, happening in your head, that's what makes your subjective experience so real, because it's real for you. And understanding how to navigate your subjective experience and the world is what we can do in therapy together. So I think there are so many sections in the book that can be so beautiful for bibliotherapy, but also not using Harry Potter as that substitute to only understand your mental health, understand therapy, but sort of using bits and pieces off the books to, one, help you reduce a little bit of that existential loneliness that no one really gets you. And also holding on to some of the bits of, you know, just because it's happening in my head, it is still valid and it is still real.
Right. Yeah, that's beautiful.
That is, yeah, I think that's such a good note to end on. Well, that brings us to the end of our episode today. And I just want to say a big thank you to Nishi Ravi for joining us to talk about this really important issue. Thank you.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Such a delightful conversation. And although I did think about leaving us with that final quote from Dumbledore, that's so, so perfect. For that, I thought I would pick something a little more off the beaten path. And Nishi, you referred a fair amount to The Order of the Phoenix, which I think is a really psychologically complex book. And I am choosing a passage from that book at the end, when Harry, Ron, Hermione, Neville, and Luna are recovering in the hospital wing at Hogwarts from the battle that they had waged at the Ministry of Magic with the Death Eaters. Ron helped himself to a handful of chocolate frogs from the immense pile on his bedside cabinet, threw a few to Harry, Ginny, and Neville, and ripped off the wrapper of his own with his teeth. There were still deep welts on his forearms where the brain's tentacles had wrapped around him. According to Madame Pomfrey, thoughts could leave deeper scarring than almost anything else. Though, since she had started applying copious amounts of Dr. Ubley's Oblivious Unction, there seemed to be some improvement. Here's to the power of health professionals everywhere, good friends, and, of course, don't forget your chocolate.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburn. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Wishing all of you the magic of health and healing. Until next time, class dismissed.